What up? I'm Rock Harper. You're now listening to the Chef Rock Experiment, the podcast. Your journey to entertainment, empowerment, and education in the food business begins right now. Let's go. Ladies and gentlemen, we are live at Torch Hop Brewing Company in Atlanta, Georgia. It's still the Dirty South? Can I still say that?
No, a little bit.
Depends on where you come from. Okay. That's like saying Hotlanta. Like, nobody in Atlanta say Hotlanta.
You can tell when somebody ain't from
Torch, right?
Yeah. I'm with two amazing guests, and I couldn't have asked for a better first duo. I got them, you know, I know they're busy and I don't know how long they're going to be here, so I got them to sit down at the same time. And both amazing guys and phenomenal chefs. My man, chef and author, Todd Richards. Welcome to the podcast, Shift Drink International Gourmet Foods. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me. Good seeing you.
Absolutely. And my main man from D.C., from the South Side, letting everybody know. JLP Thriznai. I'm going to get that right one day. My man, Chef Joseph Pierre from Southern Gentleman.
Absolutely. Good to be here, man.
Thank you.
Welcome to Atlanta.
Yes, yes. A wonderful welcome. Before we get started in the show, wonderful welcome it is. Like, there's a club next door, and that shit was popping at 6 o'clock.
At
like,
6.
Yeah. Six, I saw this one woman come in. Like, I mean, if she was naked, she would have had more clothes on.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, you know, I'm just saying, okay, all right.
Exactly.
Is that normally how it goes around here?
It depends on which part of town you're in. You know, this is Atlanta. It's home of the gentleman club. You know, everything isn't a gentleman club, but that culture and that mentality exists in the city, so.
And tonight is a Tuesday. I just want to, for people that are listening. And
Turn up Tuesdays.
Turn up Tuesday.
But, I mean, we all from big cities, so, you know, coming from Chicago, I mean, this is normal life. You know, you guys in D.C., that's normal life.
Yeah.
I think Atlanta's finally becoming less a big college town and more of a real urban city.
Yeah. So that's what it's known for. And how, when you say less a big college town, more of an urban city, Todd, how long you been here?
I've been here since 92.
92. And
I've been here for a year and a half.
Year and a half. Traveled here before?
I've traveled here several times.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I'm a Freaknik dude, so everybody, you know, people say Freaknik was a bad thing. I could tell them I'm here, so it couldn't have been all that bad, you know.
You just took it back, Slim. You took it back. So tell me about that transition from a chef's perspective. When you talk about from a college town and you've seen the growth, how does that change what you do on a day to day basis?
Well, you got to understand that, you know, when Atlanta had the Olympics, you had all these people come into the city. And they were trying to change the city, and the city rejected everyone. And then you saw this big push in Charleston. Charleston is a big shrimp and grits town. You had Sean Brock, you had Mike Lotta doing those things. So there was a lot of chefs mimicking what they were doing because they're only 4 hours away. But now people in Atlanta, they're just really cooking with their heart, with their soul. And they're finding new, you know, interesting things to cook. Or they're taking classical dishes and remixing them, doing something different. And everyone has their own niche, their own place. So we're not only Southern, but we can be Southern International. You know, we can be Southern Mexican. You know, we can be soul food, but we can be soul food in a new way where, you know, we're using collard greens in multiple dishes, not just the traditional dishes.
Yeah.
And that's really what makes Atlanta just a great place to be right now, because we have a whole landscape, you know, to cook from. And then a terroir here, growing the vegetables from here. You can't find vegetables that taste any better than from the state of Georgia. Maybe California, but really Georgia, that murky sand that things grow in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just really beautiful to cook the food that we have here.
That's what's up.
And that's a real testament to what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I've only been here for a year and a half, of course, but working at the Southern Gentleman, and that was one thing I tell people. I said, it was like, well, you're a northerner. And that was the first time I heard that. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, we're below the Mason-Dixon line. If you don't know, D.C. is technically the South. But coming from D.C., it was always one of those things where I'm not trying to change the narrative on on what we're doing. I'm trying to give you something to think about. Like, I'm trying to invigorate your thought process. I want you to understand that what you do is fine, but there's a different way to interpret this dish.
Yeah.
I don't do chicken and waffles. I love chicken and waffles, but there's 8,000 restaurants in Atlanta that do chicken and waffles.
Yeah.
I do a chicken and pancake, and I sell probably 8,000 chicken and pancakes. But it's to put that one dish in a different vessel to present it to you, yeah, just change your whole thought concept, your whole thought process of like, oh, wow, I never thought about that.
Yeah.
How I use, like you said, southern ingredients. The farms here are amazing. How I use, you know, red peas for hummus, how I use black-eyed peas for my Hop and John, like, it's really that simple. I do a three-bean salad. I do Sea Island red peas. I do black-eyed peas. I do runner beans. Like, so these things, when people think about it, it's like, well, what makes it South? Like, we use ingredients from the South. The first time I came to Atlanta, and that was a restaurant, King and Duke, a chef by the name of E.J. Hoskins, I believe, was the chef at the time. And I sat at the chef's counter, and he said, I was like, man, this is a great Southern restaurant. He's like, no, we're not. I was like, no, you're very much a Southern restaurant. He said, no, we're a modern American restaurant with local influences. And I was like, what? I was like, you're in the South. Like, he's like, no, you're in the South. Everything around you is the South, right? But I'm from D.C., right? So if I got a Southern restaurant, I got to tell you we're a Southern restaurant.
Yeah.
If I'm using this Southern, like, we're Southern influence. But here, like, you're here.
Yeah.
You're doing American food. You're using local ingredients. Like, from the outside, yeah, man, you're a great Southern restaurant. But from the perspective of the chef, like, no, we do modern American food.
Yeah.
It just happens to be these ingredients are very Southern.
Right.
But it's just how you do it. Just change the narrative.
Now, let me ask you, coming from D.C. to, so you were in, how long were you at Barcelona?
2.5 years.
So 2.5 years, Barcelona, very yep. successful concept. And we were talking prior about what you were allowed to do with the menu and how they sort of were a multi-unit concept, but they allowed the chefs some a lot of leeway with a large yep. part, which is sort of really unique and a new way of running sort of multi-unit or chains, if yep. you will. But D.C. as a diner chef to Atlanta, major difference. What's the one major difference you can think of?
The one major difference for me is it's the growth phase of where the cities are.
Yeah.
So when I left D.C., we're just fresh off the Michelin wave, right? So Michelin guy comes in. There's so many new independent smaller restaurants popping up. I mean, Bad Saints just got Bon Appetit, best new restaurant yeah. in America at the time. Michelin Guide was coming that was July. Michelin Guide was coming that October.
Yeah.
So that whole summer, everyone was on edge because they didn't know what was going to happen, what was going to be released. Staple House in Atlanta that year was number two restaurant. So when I came down to Atlanta, I was like, I need to see this Staple House restaurant. And it was good. It was really, really good. The major difference is our growth phase, as we talked earlier, our growth phase in D.C. started 2008,
yeah,
you know, to now to get it to where it's at. And for me, I feel like the Atlanta, as a visitor, that growth phase is right here. When I think I did a Top Chef casting call down here, right? So I went to the Spitz at the
recently?
Time.
Recently?
No, this is way back, like okay. 2014. It was a Richard Blaze's restaurant at the time, the Spitz. So I was over here right down the street. And I'm like, got to go there because I've seen Richard Blaze. I'm there. But that wave, I would say from 2014, like, in a steady blossoming. Like, you don't see a lot of tasting menu concepts in Atlanta, but there yeah. there exists. Like, Lazy Betty just opened up, you know, around Super Bowl time. Really good tasting menu concept.
Yeah.
D.C., you find tasting menu concepts everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's getting the public and the consumers, because it's a lot of money in Atlanta. The problem with it, the difference in D.C. and Atlanta, D.C. is all right there. It's in that bubble.
Right.
Right? Atlanta, you got to go from Decatur, you got to go to Buckhead, you got to be in Midtown, all these little places, Old Fourth Ward, like, you're in all these different areas, and it's almost like, I don't really have time to go restaurant hop. But if you're on 14th Street, you're going to walk, you know, 2 miles up the road, you might hit six or seven restaurants yeah. and be like, I did the stretch. I ran the gauntlet stuff. Of restaurants.
Right.
So you can get in these pockets. Now, each pocket has their very unique feel.
Yeah.
Edgewood is very different. I love it. I love it over there. It's raw. Got
Edgewood?
A lot of character. Yeah.
That's crazy
it's
to hear.
Character.
Edgewood is like, you mean D.C.?
No.
Oh, Edgewood
yeah.
here. We got
Edgewood
here?
Okay.
Or is it Edgewood here?
Yeah.
Yeah, Edgewood here in Atlanta.
It's crazy. well, we talk about how Edgewood's changed, but
he used to
couldn't be able to walk in Edgewood in D.C. Like
same here though. You used to not be able to walk in Edgewood on a, you know,
and now you can.
Oh yeah. Man, I mean it's totally different you place.
Know, yeah,
I live in Bankhead. That's what somebody told me. I was like, you live in Bankhead? I'm like, yeah, I live off Howe Mill Huff Road. I was like, no, you live in Bankhead. I'm like, all right, I don't think so. I live. It's very nice these days. So
listen, all right. So we had Shift Drink, right? Nighttime food show. Either you ever been to a nighttime food show?
Never.
First ever, right here, right. Claiming it. What do you think about the concept?
I think the concept is great for industry people.
Yeah.
Especially on a Tuesday, that we can actually go and really socialize and see people produce food or their products in the natural element. A lot of times these things in the daytime, and it's so crowded you can't walk through, and you only see a few purveyors, and they really don't have enough time to interact. And here, for me, it's R&D, you know, because what I like about Atlanta now is that there's actual competition among chefs.
Yeah.
Like you were talking about D.C. earlier, D.C. has competition among chefs. You're looking to see what this guy's doing on his menu, what this chef, what she's doing on her menu. And Atlanta had this big kumbaya moment where everyone was loving each other, and I hated that crap. Because me, if you walk into my restaurant as a chef, I'm going to try to blow you out the water.
Right.
You know, there's no limit on how many courses I would produce. So now there's competition here. And so I get to come here and see what everyone else is looking at, pick up on some trends, and then take that back to the restaurant, give it my cooks and chefs and say, okay, how are we going to change the world?
Yeah.
And so that makes it great to have this kind of concept here at nighttime.
Yeah. Joe, what's your, I'm here with Shift Drink, Atlanta Torch Hop Brewing Company, International Gourmet Foods nighttime food show with chef and author Ty Richards and chef Joe Pierre. What's your shift drink, Joe?
My go-to shift
what's
drink?
What's your go-to?
A Negroni.
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 Yeah.
Hands down. It's straight booze.
Yeah.
all the way, right? Like, you know, you want to go to work. I got a hard day at work. I'm getting off. I'm making a Negroni.
Yeah.
I keep the ingredients in my apartment to make Negronis.
You got it. You got it on like at the crib.
It's on standby.
Okay.
Right. Now, easy days, like, you know, if I'm off, you know, you don't want to get called into work. I make sure I get my 11 o'clock gin tonic. Like, ooh, can't make it today. I'm so sorry.
Gin and tonic. Oh my goodness.
How about you? What's
me? I'm a champagne guy. Champagne. Always have champagne and always will be.
Okay.
I mean, there's nothing better than, you know, opening that bottle. Pour a little bubbles, get a taste.
What's your brand?
I am really particular in the summertime, it's more sparkling rosé.
Okay.
In the fall, it's definitely go California. Wintertime is definitely France.
I see you. So tell me, a couple quick questions. I want to get to the book and definitely your article that just came out on The Undefeated. I thought it was dope, but I want to get to that in a second because I know we have conversations, you know, around what the article was about. But a couple joints real quick. Which, if you could say, just in general, your biggest roadblock right now is what? Both of you.
It always comes down to finance.
Money.
Yeah, it always comes down to that. It's not a limit of ideas. It's not a limit of showing people that you can run profitable restaurants. It's the limit to having access to cash to own the businesses yourself.
Yeah.
And it's really about how our community has no real way forward for us to reinvest in it so that you can understand that there's a Chinese food restaurant, there's a deli, there's a burger place in every community around the country. But the most oldest cuisine in the world of the United States, which really is touted in soul food, there's not one in every single community. That means because we have no access to capital to open up a soul food place in every single place. But there is a taco place. You know, there's a Chinese food place. There's a deli. There's a burger type place. You know, there's a fried chicken place. And fried chicken is universally Southern, but every culture in the world has fried chicken.
Yeah.
I'm saying, but something distinctly that is black and about black culture, the reason why we can't do it is because we don't have cash in order to go and open these places.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think the biggest roadblock for you?
I would agree with him to a degree, capital, but we kind of talked about it earlier. It's the biggest roadblock for me is battling myself. It's the terror of, are you ready to be a restaurateur, or are you looking to get a James Beard Award as an executive chef? that's my personal battle.
I got you. I got you. You know, in that though, I think you can do both. I really do think you can do both. I've seen, you know, all our good friends and ours have done both. You know, being nominated 3 times, I knew that that could not just be the ends and the means, because there's no guarantee after you win that any more financial success will happen, nor will it actually affect our community, because our community is not exposed to James Beard. So we have to have a two-pronged approach in order to change that tide. So, you know, we got to win the award. We also got to find a way to open up in our community, because our legacy is going to be about how we change our own community and make it better for the world to consume. And then, being a restaurateur, we can open up 50 restaurants around the world based off of winning that
Absolutely.
One award.
Absolutely.
So let me ask, well, you raised some good, some very interesting part. We could probably sit and talk for 3 hours.
Right.
I get fired up. But let me ask you this. Just as a chef in general, what is your biggest, like, what's your go-to for inspiration? Like, how do you, so you talked about R&D here, right? You're both here, you both have restaurants. Where are you looking? Like, a lot of guys are looking on Instagram, a lot of guys reading magazines, trade shows. What are your top areas for, like, resources to where you find out what's on trend and what you're gonna do next?
For me, it's my class. Like, the cooks who are line cooks with me,
yeah.
I call them every day. We talk to each other every day as if we still go to work at 2 o'clock and we're about to punch in and do prep.
Mm-hmm.
It's my peers in industry. I do look at other restaurants, I go to other restaurants, but I'm inspired by the people around me.
Yeah.
Because I always say, sometimes you're only good as your circle sometimes.
Yeah.
And you might gotta go outside your circle for that inspiration, but the people around me continuously push me to be better.
Gotcha.
And you have to have that. Whether it's family or friends, I tell people, I dream about food. Like, I will conceptually dream about how I cook this entire dish, wake up in the morning, I will go to Buford Highway in an Uber, get what I need, come back and cook it.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, it has to get done that moment. I went to Breska in DC, Michelin star restaurant. Ryan's awesome, awesome chef. He had a foie gras beignet. I was like, oh, this is dope. Like, foie beignet. It was nice, but the concept, it was a savory beignet, but it was a foie torchon. I was like, nah, I got it. All right, it's good. The yeah. torchon is legit. The gelée on top is legit. The beignet is legit. So I was like, I came back to Atlanta. I was like, look, we're going to do these crawfish beignets. I'm like, what? So I R&D crawfish beignets till I got it right.
Yeah.
Crawfish beignets is going on my October fall menu nice. At the Southern Gentleman, 3035 Peachtree Road, Northeast Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah.
But look, it's a crawfish beignets. I put crawfish in the mix, right? I do an Old Bay aioli with it.
You put this on Instagram. I saw that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I did a shrimp powder.
Okay.
Because like, I tasted it, and the owner's like, you need, like, powdered sugar, because the beignets got powdered sugar. I'm like, no. Like, I did a shrimp powder. I roasted some shrimp shells, olive oil, maltodextrin, made this shrimp powder with it.
Nice.
I was like, bro, this is everything in life. But it came from that moment. It's like, because I've never thought of a savory beignet. You know, you go to restaurants, oh, shrimp beignets is really like a fritter batter, and they just drop it in the fryer. Like, to make a true yeast beignet, like, in a restaurant, you're like, we about to serve these all night. Like, hey, you like, I need to see how it's going to come out this freezer into this fryer and make it happen.
Yeah.
But
so you're pissed. How about you, top source of inspiration?
I love the term nerd, because I feel like I'm a nerd.
Yeah,
I mean, it doesn't matter to me. I get books that are old, falling apart. I still go back to Ferran's book, you know, the El Bulli book. I go to the Fat Duck book. I go to Edna Lewis book. You know, I'll call my friends. I still take it as straight competition. You know, it is a competition to me to be the absolute best.
Yeah.
And I will rest at nothing to be the best.
That's what's
so
up.
You know, like Jay say, he don't sleep, you know,
yeah.
or he dreams about food, you know. Me, I don't sleep,
yeah.
you know, and I can't stand losing, you know. I can't stand someone being better than me out of just I think they're better than me. You know, that just doesn't rest with me. It doesn't rest with my cooks.
Yeah.
And my cooks are brilliant. And they get mad at me because I get on the line with them, because I have no problem. I am still a chef that gets on the line and cooks with my cooks.
Yeah, you got to let them know. You got to remind them.
You know,
this is what I do.
Hey, you know what?
I started this.
You know what Allen Iverson said? Oh, broken down Jordan, still better than half the guys in the league.
No bullshit. That's
you know, right?
That's
so
true.
It's the same time of mentality. Hey,
yeah.
If you don't want to do it, I can do it myself.
I got a question for you, both of you. Who plays you in a movie?
Who plays me in the movie?
Yep, actor plays you in a movie.
Donald Glover.
Okay.
Donald Glover.
Well, Childish Gambino. Who plays you?
Everyone tells me, like, people will stop me. Are you Forrest Whitaker?
Yes.
Right? Like,
yes.
I see it.
I was like, why do people say that? Like, I look nothing like Forrest Whitaker.
I see
it. I get so mad. Like, first of all black people don't look alike, okay? But every place, I can sit in a
No, but
place,
you got that. You got that.
And people will say, yeah, are you Forrest Whitaker? Like, no, no, ma'am, I'm not.
Yeah.
You know?
And I see the
Donald Glover. Look.
Yeah.
Look, this is a good talk. We always talk about representation in food, right?
Yeah.
Broccoli City in D.C. They're
coming
doing
up.
A food fest now.
Yeah.
Food and Grooves.
And I saw that.
I reached out to the founder. I was like, man, this is great. It's having the conversation. You know, they want to represent, you know, the misrepresented.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, I always look at the list. I'm like, I ain't in D.C., but I was like, you know, none of these cats from D.C.
Hey.
You know? I'm always on it. Like, wait, I need to be a part of this event.
So talk.
Like, I'm in Atlanta, but I'm,
right.
I need to be. I'm from D.C. You having this event in D.C.
Right.
I need D.C. representation. I said they got some hitters on the list now. I was like, you know, this is a good list.
So why is that important?
Because.
And I'm gonna set that up a little bit, because I think that. You know, I don't say I got in a little trouble. A couple of my peers called me because I don't always call bullshit because I see a lot of bullshit.
Yeah.
But I call truth, and when I use my platform, I use it. And if I see some shit, it doesn't matter who's on the other side of that table.
Yeah.
To me, we got to call it out. And there's this perception, especially as black chefs are growing and we're doing phenomenal things. Certain shit we got to keep in house, I understand.
Right.
But if you know, like we can't appropriate or we can't misstep within our own culture.
Right.
I'm not saying that's your answer, but I'm curious as to why you say, even within, because Kwame's hosting, mm-hmm. Questlove is there, Broccoli City's a
JJ's
black...
JJ's there.
Yeah, so why... JJ from New York?
Yeah.
So why is it important to you that D.C. have representation?
Because growing up as a young chef in D.C., and I was, like I said, I felt I was better than everyone else. You just didn't... No one wrote about me.
Yeah.
No one told you about me. Tom Cecil gave me a great write-up. And then people like started talking about me. But for me, as a DC chef, it was one of those, like, we're a big market. Like, you need to know that there are people just like me and you who have the same goal in mind to be the best that are out there. I came out of the era where, you know, Jose Andres runs the city. Like, everyone loves Jose. Everyone loves, at the time, everyone was loving Mike, right? Isabella, like, everyone was loving these chefs. And it was like, there's a slew of chefs. There wasn't, it's always talked about. Every year goes, like, where's the representation of African American chefs? We're the African American chefs. Like, they are there.
It is.
If you tap into it.
It's not getting the ink.
Like, they're not getting the ink.
But the bigger problem is that, and especially in a city like Atlanta, they are going to personal chef
and
they're going to catering. And what I'm saying is, or I talk about the economics of it, is that though you own your personal chef and though you own your catering, you're very limited in the media view of what you can accomplish. And so social media is changing that a little bit for them, but for chefs like ourselves, we have to have foundational places for media to understand what we're doing.
Well, how do we do that?
We have to work together. I mean, look what you're doing.
Right.
I mean, you're bringing the work. You know, we're sitting here talking about it.
Right.
You know, but economically, we have to pool our money. You have to look at all the other communities in this country,
yeah,
and how they do those things and how they pool their money together and get things open.
Yeah.
And we have it. We have enough celebrities. We have enough money to do this and do it in a way that we're not infringing on each other's creativity. You know, look at Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang is a great model for for success when it comes about how you had a group of brothers that got together who, you know, had a vision and took care of each other. And of course, there's always strife, there's always fallout, there's always those things like that. But the core mission was that they all worked together in order to get those things done.
Well, you know, and, go ahead, Joe.
I was like, and this, he said, pulling each other up, right? If I have this platform, I want you to be on this platform too.
Yeah.
I gotta reach out to my brother and say, yo, come to this event with me. I wanna introduce you to XYZ.
Right.
Come to this event with me. I wanna introduce you to XYZ. Robert Gatsby's one of my greatest mentors.
Yeah.
He's a wild, wild cat. He can cook, he'll work harder than anyone I've known, like, yo. But Robert always used to say to me, he said, when he hired me, he said, what do you need to survive? I was like, what? He's like, how much money do you need to survive? Like, I'm like, I don't know, $1,000 a week. I didn't care. Like, just I need a job at this point. But if you can't pull your brother up when you make it, that's a big, like, I love my platform when I get it.
Yeah.
But who can I bring along? I got a scholarship to go to college. Merrill Lynch paid for my college education, right? So when I get money in charity events and stuff, I try to give back and go. I go to speak to high schools and stuff like that. That's because that opportunity was given to me so I can give it back to you. Because your platform is my platform.
Yeah.
If I want you to speak, you want me to speak. You know, I want my sous chef here. Whenever I can, like, yo, come meet this event.
Yeah.
Why? Because they need to see you.
You got
to
lift up. You got to lift
up. You got to lift them up.
You know, so you said something that I think what's important is that there's an idea, this public, this outside affirmation. Nothing wrong with awards. It's almost like I liken it to like the Grammys and like hip hop and rap. There's everybody wants we know we like that. We want the affirmation, but I feel like hip hop, you bring up Wu-Tang at a certain point, and any true artist, right? If you look at artists, we all go through this period of, are you gonna choose, am I chasing the affirmation? Or am I chasing my passion? Am I walking in my path? And when you walk in that path, a lot of times you're gonna have a lot of shitty days, a lot of shitty years, or years, you know, it's gonna be dark. But then when the dawn comes, many times you get that breakthrough, right? It's darkest before dawn. So often, not always, but often there becomes a choice. Like you said earlier, you can have both, I believe that, but there's a choice. And many times we, as black chefs, I see, we're chasing the James Beard, we're chasing the Rammies, and we're not focusing on just working our shit. Like what you said in the article, in the Undefeated. Being proud of what we are, the cuisine. I've said for many years, not said, I believe, I know, black food is American cuisine. Soul food, like, we are it's the true American. My Native American friends would disagree with that.
Right.
But it's a true cuisine. So basically focusing on, you know, your passion. And if the awards come, great, but make great art. You bring up a great point with rap. Like you brought up Wu-Tang, which is like an awesome segue to my next question. Greatest rapper of all time. Very important question. And I know you work for, you have one of his restaurants? I saw something with a very prominent Atlantean.
I don't want to compromise you
with this question is what I'm saying.
Well, you don't have to compromise. Right. I can digress very easily out of that question because though I appreciate rap, being from Chicago, I'm a house music guy.
Okay.
You know, and a disco guy. So rap to me is really about feeling. So I just listen to people that give me that same feeling, like Chance the Rapper, you know, Drake. I like Ludacris because I think he represents the best part of Atlanta culture.
Yeah.
You know, that you can go from rags to riches in Atlanta. If you can't make it in Atlanta, I can tell you can't make it nowhere.
Okay.
Because there's plenty of opportunity here. I have an old school mind when it comes to it. I love Wu-Tang. I love the way, you know, that whole crew came about. Also like what people are doing now.
Yeah.
You know, there's no limit to it. It's just like, you know, collard greens. I love the way my great-grandmother cooked collard greens. You know, but the way I cook collard greens now, it's so futuristic from what you consider collard greens. That's the progression about black culture, is that we don't necessarily get stuck in one thing. We take those same traditions, those same foundations, we blow them up consistently,
yeah.
You know, remix them and redo them again, and now it's a whole new thing, steeped in the culture that we came to this world.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with it. Great. Go. Who's your go?
Jay-Z.
Okay.
LL was my guy. And then I heard Imaginary Players by Jay-Z, and I was sold.
Since Imaginary,
I was sold. I was like, yo, his style, his swag, like everything about the cat. I was watching MTV, smoking a cigar. I was like, who smokes cigars? I know no one that looks this age that smokes cigars. Like, cigars was old dudes in conversion vans fixing cars in alleys to me. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Big mustaches, like,
yeah.
Nah.
Yeah.
But so Jay-Z.
Two out of three on this panel, Jay-Z's the GOAT. Because I'm going Jigga all day. And I would open up the can on the NFL joint. I ain't going to do. We could talk offline about that. Because I think actually chefs can learn a lot from that. Finish this sentence for me. The restaurant industry needs.
The restaurant industry needs a revolution.
Okay. Okay.
It needs a revolution. There's a lot of, it's of terror of, there's no middle age right now. It's new age and there's the old age.
Yeah.
It needs a revolution because there is a middle ground that the business hasn't found yet. And it's kind of like, we're hard, the old school guys, and we're the food truck. I got some money and opened my own restaurant, fresh out of college guys.
Yeah.
But there's no middle ground. It needs a revolution. And that's going to balance everything out, or no one's going to have jobs.
The restaurant industry needs simplicity. We got to make things a little bit simple for everyone that works in business. I mean, you got to make it simple for cooks not to incur going to culinary school, come out with $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt. We got to make it simple for restaurant owners to understand how to pay real wages, you know, for people to survive. We got to make it simple for women who work in the industry not to feel like they're going to be broke and mistreated or make less wages just because they're women. We got to make this thing simple so that average people that love to cook can actually strive in this business.
Yeah, yeah, love that. I mean, you're talking about revolution and simplicity. Both of those things are, I mean, I don't say easy, but simple in nature, but sort of big in execution.
Yeah.
But you know, that's how shit happens. Like, you make bold moves. Last question, sort of. I want to find out, like, we're here, IGF. Like, I love International Gourmet Foods. I've been buying from them since my B. Smith days back in the day, in the late 90s. But, you know, it's a food distributor, right? We buy from different people all over the country. What is something that, and this is, you know, separate of IGF, we in their space, but what is something that you want to see from Broadline or just distributors in general?
This is great. Being from DC, certain rules, just different rules apply. I mean, be more chef restaurant friendly, because I can't tell you what I need at 5:30.
So what does that mean? Hold up. So you're saying be more chef
restaurant friendly, because I can't tell you what the restaurant needs at 5:30 p.m. if I did zero sales.
So
give me a later cutoff time. You know, a lot of guys don't have late cutoff times. Like, you know, I call a couple vendors in D.C. at midnight for my seafood delivery, and it's there at 6 in the morning. So be more chef restaurant friendly. I think it's going to work out. You know, the Broadline guys, hey, look, everyone has a life. I get that too. But a lot of these restaurants lose in costs because they can't even control it, because they're trying to forecast something they haven't even seen yet. So.
I got that. And I'm going to tell you who fucking the game up. Amazon about to fuck all this shit up. I'm building a joint. And I don't know your experience with it, but I looked into it because I'm just like, how can this exist with all this technology? I could order seafood for real. I go to produce at 1, 2 a.m. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It might come a little late. How has nobody innovated in the Broadline space? Amazon, I looked the other day, right? I'm thinking, oh, Amazon, sure. You know, you think you got a good idea.
They already on it, champ. I think it's coming, and I don't know what they're gonna do, but Cisco, U.S. Foods, you better listen. I think they're gonna do something. But same question to you. The broadline industry vendors need to do what?
What vendors really need to understand is that we are in a guest-focused business. That we are trying to really, you know, cater to what the guests are asking for. So innovation has to be a part of what they look at. You talk about delivery and things like that.
Yep.
As part of innovation. You have to also think about the things that are of critical mass. Is that space in restaurants is becoming more confined, smaller. So then think about packet size. You know, everything does not necessarily have to be this big, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we need things smaller, you know, because every square foot we're paying rent for. So don't bring me, a case of something that has all these in it. Give me one box that can house those things.
Yeah.
So it's just really just using innovation to deliver their product in a more efficient manner, which then affects their bottom line, which passes savings on to us, which then affects the consumer or the guest that we serve.
Yes. And if I've had several chefs tell me, I'm not gonna order a case, or even if it's a 750 mil or a gallon or something, even if I can get it all I need is a cup. Amazon, Prime, that shit coming next day. I'm talking about some of the most wicked ingredients 20 years ago we didn't have access to, Prime membership, or just getting it online. So
I think the only other thing too is, like, there's a lot of farms around us. Don't send me something from California when there's a dairy right down the street. Like that makes no sense to me. I love California, but there's a dairy right down the street. You know, don't send me, you know, things from a whole nother place, you know, where I know right down the street, you know, there's a guy producing it. It saves you money, saves me money. But that means that someone just not thinking or not, you know, taking a risk, or, because as chefs and restaurateurs, we take risk every single day.
Yeah.
You know, we're taking a risk counting on this company to deliver at this stuff at this point in time.
Yeah.
So they really have to think about really how to localize the market in the same way you talk about Amazon and everything like that. They are a worldwide company who's taking advantage of localizing the market.
Now, I will say this. I'm going to go sort of against myself. In the Amazon nation, in the Walmartization of our culture, our, you know, the way we buy things, we have to be mindful that ease and convenience can screw you in the long run, right? So that same, I'm ordering this product, this Calabrian chili that I love, in an 8-ounce jar. Which Calabrian chili is, that's a bad example. But I'm ordering something I could get from down the street because of convenience, because I can do it on my phone. And then 10 years later or 5 years later, the little guy can't compete with that. I rented a bike the other day. I'm up in Cape Cod, and I bought some lights for my bike. And I looked on Amazon, they were like $8. From the dude in the store, they were like $15. Damn, they're double. I understand. He's like, I can't compete with that. I understand. I bought it from him because that matters, right? It's $7. Everybody can't, you know what I'm saying? That's relative to what I was buying. But what I'm arguing against myself, we want to use technology, but we also want to think about the farmer down the street.
But us as artists, we will never let that happen. See, that's the thing.
You don't think?
As artists?
I think we're letting it happen right now.
But I think us, from understanding convenience, that we go out of our way, we inconvenience ourselves to find the best products, the best things in the world to serve.
If you can, though.
Yeah.
How long you been cooking? You've been cooking a long time.
Yeah.
You're OG, and you are that guy, right? Certain chefs are in positions. I know I've been, let me speak about me. I've been in a position where it's not enough time in a day. I don't have the money. I don't have the resources. I don't have the know-how, right, to even know how to do that. My boss is like, nah, we ain't buying from that motherfucker down the street. We're buying from there because I have a deal, right? They make these big deals. I don't care if you buy it out of your own pocket. We're not buying that. And I'm not saying that it's a total black and white, but is that realistic to think that?
But it has to be realistic, because not we'll be a homogenized society.
Yeah.
And then we will, you know, weigh ourselves out of it, and then there will be no culture. And then if there's no culture, then there's no world to live in.
It's
and so the defining moments of culture is how you build the machine and how you rage against your own machine that you built.
And
that is the way that we live in this country. Yeah. And this is how we as black people have survived. You know, every time we do something and everyone, someone else copies it, we tear it all the way down and we redo it again. So I think there's a way to do it, you know? And I believe, you know, if us three can't figure it out, there's plenty of people in our community that can all come together and figure it out as well.
And it has to be that. Now, I agree with you. Like, that convenience factor, man, I love it to a degree. But then there's that part of, man, I really like this farm. This was my company now. They're okay with me ordering from anywhere, as long as I get the paperwork in. Like, you can order from anywhere you want. Barcelona was the same way. You can have as many vendors as you want. I ordered vegetables from the chef's garden. Like, were there sweet potatoes? Awesome, absolutely, the best sweet potatoes I have in life. Did I pay $300 for them? Yes, I did.
Right.
Did I hear about it? Yes. How I delivered that product to the guests was the most important thing the owners cared about. I was like, you paid for this, you're gonna represent this product the best way you can. I don't want you to bastardize it by trying to turn it into something else. I want this sweet potato to shine as is. Being in Atlanta, it's a company called Farm, and it was kind of a new, they work as a liaison with all these farmers. I can get product from Macon, Georgia, that this guy can't probably get up here every day, right? But he raises awesome pigs. But man, these are great pigs. I really want this in my restaurant. Farm allows the restaurant, like, we'll get it to you. And it gives the farmer the platform. It gives the chef, when you talk about newer chefs, right? Look, I'm on my phone, I got an app. And that convenience fee, like, oh, I want turkey eggs, right? Like, I can look at my farm app and say, who got turkey eggs? It's a farmer up in Georgia.
It's an Atlanta thing.
Yeah, so it's...
This is a Georgia thing.
It's a Georgia thing.
Farmed.
But
it's an app, okay.
It puts the farmers to the forefront of chefs. So you have younger chefs, right, who don't understand how that works. You have restaurants who really want to get into the local thing, but don't understand how it works, and like, we can't do this, we don't cut checks. They allow you to operate a business through the farms. It's one invoice, right? You're paying a bunch of farms. You're paying one invoice, and they're making it happen.
Oh, that's tight. I never heard of it. Farm.
It's a beautiful thing.
I mean, okay. I look at Farm. I also look at International Gourmet Foods.
Yeah.
I mean, who really support local cheesemakers. You know, I mean, there was a big push of cheese, and like, beer culture has gone up in Atlanta, cheese culture has gone up, you know, in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And you also, you know, have a company that is a I would say a broadliner in a sense, like International Gourmet, but they also are supporting local cheesemakers, in which everyone can have access to.
Yeah.
So they have taken a different approach than the other broadliners. Because they actually research what's around us,
yeah,
and knows what chefs want. And that, to me, is where the power comes in. Because now that we're all serving this cheese, when this next small cheesemaker comes up, we're all going to race to get that one first, you know, because everyone has it. And there's nothing wrong with the one that we were doing before, but now that there's this new person coming, we all got to get it first.
Yeah. Yes, sir. We move it. We move the culture. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for being on the show. Chef JLP Thriznai out in the Thriznai. Leave us, tell us what you're doing next. You know, what's next for you?
Next thing I got coming up, I'm going to be up in D.C. with you. Heart and Soul. September 26th.
September 26th. Appreciate you, man.
So
thank you.
I'm flying up for that. I'm ready. I'm excited.
That means a lot.
We're going to put together some sweet potato biscuit with shrimp and tasso ham gravy. I'm using Spotted Trotter tasso ham. They're out here locally in Atlanta, so I'm loving it.
Thank you, man. Just so people are listening, that is in support of, you know, to the homelessness with Central Union Mission, a faith-based nonprofit in D.C., and you've always been a supporter, and... You know, I was thrilled to see that you were going. I knew you were down here, so I don't be bothering, brothers. I know how it is to be a chef, so I appreciate you, man, coming up from Atlanta to do the event.
No problem.
It means a lot. Chef Todd Richards, chef and author, and just dynamic. What's next, man? You Forrest Whitaker come?
Wow, that'd be crazy. Yeah. You know, I really just want to change the world one bite at a time. That's my goal. Support my charity, A Wholesome Wave Georgia. really affect SNAP benefits. You know, we match dollar for dollar at local farmers markets for low-income families, meaning that if you spend $50, we'll give you $50 at local farmers market, providing fresh fruits and vegetables to families. Also, you know, just really talking about the culture and how we can change, you know, the dynamics of the financial institutions so that chefs like ourselves have more access to capital to open our restaurants, you know, for the people in our community and really change the legacy of Black people across the world.
Man, I love it, man. I didn't know you were a Wholesome Wave. That Michelle Nashon, right?
Yeah, Michelle Nashon, September 15th. And since you're here, you're going to be there now because I can recruit you straight here.
What, you got a joint coming up?
Yeah, September 15th. It's the Southern Chef's Potluck, 10-year anniversary of Wholesome Wave. It's one of the best and really it's one of the most fun events because all the chefs, all they have to do is bring their food to the event. We have a staff back there that will reheat, you know, put things out for them. The chefs get to mingle with everyone in the crowd. And it really talks about community.
Love
that. We bring farmers in, so that's what. And actually, Michelle Nashon is actually coming to this event because it is a 10-year event.
Shout out to Michelle Nashon. Good dude. Been on the forefront of that.
Yeah. I mean, if you give me real dollars to really low-income families that could use the support,
no doubt.
Especially as the government is now taking. I don't mean going on a high horse, but they're actually just kicked 3 million people off of SNAP benefits and reduced 500,000 kids from getting school lunch. So it's part of our community. We have to go and reverse that whole tie and continue to make sure that people are voting because we cannot allow people to go poor and hungry in this country.
Vote. Absolutely. Vote. Listen, I'm going to a conference up in Princeton with James Beard in October.
I'll be right there with you.
We got to do it, man. We got to figure out because we're the change agents. Chef Joe Pierre. Chef Todd Richards, I appreciate y'all coming on Shift Drink right here, International Gourmet Foods at Top Torch Hot Brewery right here in Atlanta. I'm going to say it in Hotlanta. I'm the Bama that came down here and said Hotlanta. Thanks, guys, for coming on the show.
All right, thank
absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm Rock Harper, and you've been listening to the Chef Rock Experiment podcast. You can follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you've made it this far, take a moment to head on over to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me next week for another episode of the Chef Rock Experiment, TCRX. Until then, thank you for listening.